All right, we're ready for Genesis 8 and 9. We're right in the middle of the story of the flood. The flood begins in chapter 6, and the story continues through our tonight's lesson, chapter 9. This is our outline that we're following, the early history. We've covered creation, the fall. We're in the middle of the flood. We finish that tonight. And the next time we talk about the Tower of Babel. That's not all that's in chapters 10 and 11, but that's the heart of what that story is about. Then we get into the patriarchal history. Let's review where we've been. Chapter 1. Creation, 6 days of creation. Chapter 2, man in the garden. Chapter 3, all right, yeah, the fall of man, Adam and Eve sin. Chapter 4, yeah, Cain and Abel. Chapter 5, or to be one easy to remember because it's a difficult chapter to read. Genealogies, yeah, from Adam to Noah. Chapter 6. Yeah, reasons and preparation for the flood. So getting ready for the flood, and here's the reason for the flood, the wickedness of man. And then chapter 7 was, yeah, the flood itself destroys the world. All right, this is something you saw last time. This is just a reminder, if you don't have a marginal note somewhere, probably at the beginning of chapter, end of chapter 5, beginning of chapter 6, that the what we learned from chapter 5, this is the age of the earth in the last column over here at the time of the birth of the sun. But anyway, at the 600th year of Noah, we're looking at 1656 years. So that just gives us kind of a general timetable from the day from creation to the point of the flood has been about 1656 years is what we learned from Genesis chapter 5. All right, here's chapter 8 now. What's chapter 8 about? Question 1. All right, he's going to come out of the ark in chapter, the flood was in chapter 7, it's still going in chapter 8, he comes out of the ark in chapter, in chapter 7, he comes out in chapter 8. So I simply call it Noah comes out of the ark. All right, let's work our way through this, and we're going to add some other slides along the way to help us make some sense of this, I hope. But four things are going to happen in Genesis 8, and the first is the fact that the waters decreased. They rescinded or they subsided, however you choose to word that. The waters decreased in verses 1 to 5. So God remembered Noah and all the living animals. I'm not going to read every word here. And he made a wind to pass, and the waters subsided. So wind helped dry out the earth and caused the waters to rescind. What else happened to so that the world begins to dry up? Verse 2. God caused two things to happen. All right. Basically, God turned the two faucets off that he'd had going to bring the flood. That's basically what that tells us in verse 2. Now, the waters rescended continually. At the end of 150 of the 150 days, the waters decreased. Now, let's talk about the 150 days right here. We looked at the beginning of this, and if you didn't catch this, I can either send it to you and copy it down now, and this will probably be the last time we'll see this slide concerning the chronology. I borrow this from Warren Wiersbe, and just kind of breaking it down by the month, the second month and the 10th day, the end of the ark, and second month and the 17th day, the rain starts, and then the rain stops at chapter 7, verse 12, on the third month and 26th day. Somewhere right in this area, right here, between that rain stopping right here and resting at Mount Ararat, it'd be the 150 days that are mentioned. Now, we came across 150 days in chapter 7 and in verse 24. But there's some question exactly what's encompassed in the 150 days. And what I mean by that, Willis suggests in his work that there were 40 days followed by 110 days, making the 150 days, that the 150 counts the 40 days it rained. Others suggest that it came in sequence to that, meaning you had the 40 days of the rain, and then you had 150 days. I'm not sure that makes a big difference, or it would be clarified a little better perhaps for us in the text. But I'll leave that for you to figure out for yourself. I want to think that the 150 was an addition to the 40. But be that as it may, after the 40 days, you have 150 days, or you have another 110, however you choose to interpret that. But I'm just trying to give you kind of a timetable. It's going to fit in right in this area right here after the rain stops. Some think it starts right here on the second month. But right in here is where the 150 days fits in. Let's go to verse 5. The water decreased continually until the 10th month. And let's see, I've lost my place. Yeah, verse 5. The waters decreased continually until the 10th month. And the 10th month, the first day of the month, the top of the mountains were seen. But I want to come back to verse 4. I skipped verse 4. The ark rested in the 7th month on the mountain of Ararat. We'll come back to Ararat. Let's just keep that in the back of our mind. So here we are in the 7th month. And the 17th day of the month is when it came to rest on Mount Ararat. Now, there seems to be, if I counted right, that's about 2.5 months at verse 5 that the ark came to rest on the top of the mountains before the top of the mountains were seen. Does that make sense? I think it's 74 days if I counted right. And that's assuming that the months that they're speaking of, not parallel exactly with our months, and there's some question, are they going by a solar year or lunar year? I'll leave that for you to pursue with all the commentaries, and you'll get hung up on that if you delve very deeply in that. So what was these 30-day months, or some of them have 31? I'm not sure. So that's why we're not sure exactly the number of days, but approximately 74 days right here from the time it came to rest on Mount Ararat until you see the top of the mountain. So they're sitting there for about 2.5 months in the ark, sitting still and not continuing to move. Make sense? All right, that's what's going on. Now, what we're going to learn in the rest of this, and we'll see this again in just a moment, we're going to see kind of the time play of all of this, but I'm going to go back to our outline just for a moment here and continue to make our way through. Any questions on verses 1 to 5? The water decreasing, the timetable, there's 150 days that the water, apparently it rained for 40 days, and then for that 110 or 150, whichever you interpret that, then the waters continue to rise. It's much like we have in a local flood. We could have a rain for a week, but the waters are going to rise probably for another week after that. Does that make sense? They're going to continue to rise. And so they did for 150 days. And then it finally comes to rest on Mount Ararat, and then it's about 2.5 months before they see the top of the mountains at all. All right, we together? All right, let's start at verse 5 now, or verse 6. Noah's going to send the raven and the doves out to see if the ground is dry. But verse 6 says, came to pass at the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made. Now, what's interesting to me, well, let's get ahead of ourselves. I'm going to come back to that slide right there in a minute. No, let's go ahead and do that. There were 40 days for what this is interesting to us. There's 40 days of the rain right here. Then you had 74 days that I've already mentioned. Then there's 40 days between seeing the mountain and sending the dove out, according to chapter 8 in verse 6, and beginning also at verse 8, and then 7 more days the dove is sent out after the raven and the dove sent out. Make sense? Kind of our timetable, what we're talking about. So we haven't got down here to verse 13 and 14, but Noah removed the cover. We'll talk about what that is or may be at verse 13 in a moment on the first day of the first month. And remember, he entered the second month and the 10th day, and they came out on the second month and the 17th day. That makes 1 year and seven, 1 year and what's that, 7 days, 17 days. 1 year and 17 days in the ark. Make sense? Gives you kind of a timetable of what all is going on in the ark. Now, let's talk about Mount Ararat, where this is and where this might be. This, if you recognize here, is the Jordan River. We have Jerusalem. This is generally the land of Palestine right here. This would be the Fertile Crescent, and this Saudi Arabia right here in the middle of that circle, you see Mount Ararat. That's in modern Turkey is where that is. Now, to say the ark came to rest in the mountains of Ararat, that doesn't locate a single place. That's like a plane crashing in the Rockies. Where in the Rockies? We don't know exactly. Just in the Rockies. Same thing is, there's a region of mounts, not just one single mount, but a region of mountains there. We don't know for sure. This is thought to be Mount Ararat. This is what they call Mount Ararat in modern Turkey. There have been several excavations there. Some of the more notable creationists have been there and have thought they may perhaps have found something that resembled the ark. Henry Morris is one. You can check the documentary In Search of Noah's Ark. Henry Morris is quoted in that. He's interviewed in that and thinks perhaps they found it. I don't know. I'm not convinced 100% of that. Make sense so far? Now, Now let's go on and talk about this window now at verse 6. You probably made a note when we were at chapter 6 and in verse 16, there was the window mentioned there. So let's go back to chapter 6 and verse 16. In building the ark, you shall make a window in the ark, the text says. I'm at 6 and 16. You shall finish it a cubit from above. Well, that probably had reference to something like you see at the top of this. You say, that doesn't look like a window that I know, or maybe something, this is very similar right here. But this may give you a better picture of what chapter 6 and verse 16 is talking about, some upper ventilation. And so as we think of a window, we think of something of a casement that you look through. Obviously, there wouldn't be glass in this, but we think of a window. That's not what we're to be thinking of. This is more of a roof. In fact, it's translated roof. Well, when you come to chapter 8 now, and you probably made a note of this in chapter 8 and verse 6 last time, that this is not the same word. So don't confuse chapter 8 and 6 with 6 and 16. Now, is it the same thing? Well, if it is, two different Hebrew words were used. And so I take chapter 8 and verse 6 to not be talking about this ventilation at the top or this roof at the top that was a cubic up from above, so apparently a cubic high. And so that's why several diagrams that you'll see, artist rendition, will have something very similar. That's generally what scholars think that referred to. But that's not what chapter 8 and verse 6 is talking about. And again, there's no indication that's talking about a casement as such, but it's an opening somehow. That there was an opening. Maybe he created something in the side or in the top. We don't know. Wherein he could let the dove out. So he opened the window, in other words, the opening that he had made, and that's all I know about that. Does that make sense? We're not given any more description, so I can speculate where it was, but we're not told where it was. Was it at the front part of the ark, in the back of the ark, at the very top, or was it on the side, or was it in the roof? I don't know where this was. We're not told. But he opens the window, and he lets the dove out and the raven out. Now, let's get ahead of ourselves to chapter 8 and verse 13. He later removes a covering so he could see if the ground was dry. So I take it from this window, whatever it was, at chapter 8 and verse 6, and this is speculation, but I'm basing it on chapter 8 and verse 13, that window must not have been big enough for him to look out, or maybe the height, I don't know what it was, but he could not see the ground, or else why did he take the covering off to see the ground? Does that make sense? Apparently couldn't see the ground to see if it was dry. Not from this window that he let the dove out. So, was it vertical so that it went up and he let the dove out and it came back? I don't know. But apparently it wasn't a big window in the side where he could look out and see the ground, but then he still needed to take the covering off so he could see the ground. That doesn't make sense to me. Does that make sense? That it doesn't make sense. All right. Now, let's continue this section. What does he do at verse 7? There are four events of sending out birds. What's the first one? Sends out a raven, and what does it do? Goes to and fro. That means it went out and came back. How many times? We don't know. It just said it came to and fro, apparently. It would go out, come back in, go out and come back in, go out and come back in. It was going to and fro until the waters were dried up. So for some time, this bird would go out and come back in, indicating it's not finding a place to land. Does that make sense? Secondly, he sends out a dove at verse 8 to see if the water had been abated. And what does the dove find? No place for the sole of her foot. And so she came back and he drew her back into the ark. All right. This is the third time. The dove goes out with an olive leaf. Yeah. All right. Now that's significant because we're told that olive trees do not grow in the upper part of the mountains, but in the lower areas, indicating the waters had receded considerably by this point. Is that making sense? So it's not like a tree that grows here at the same level where the ark may be, but the waters have, which he may not be able to see, the waters have rescended way down. How far down are they? Well, far enough that he knows that there's an olive tree that has begun to sprout and began to grow. Alfred Edersheim suggests, for what it may be worth, that olive trees, at least some olive trees, can grow and bud even underwater. So perhaps as the water got lower, even though they were still covered, they began to bud and they began, as they began to receive some sun, perhaps, I don't know. And so it indicated at least that there's growth and that the waters have receded. Making sense? All right. There was a fourth time at verse 12, and what happens at verse 12? Yeah, sends the dove out and doesn't come back, and so he knows the waters have been abated. She does not return again. All right, now that gets the second section. Noah sends out the raven and doves, and he knows the water is gone. Now, at verse 13 beginning, this third section here, Noah and his family and the animals come out of the ark. Now, verse 13 says this was in the 601st year. And if you want to make a reference back to chapter 6, remember it, chapter 7 and verse 6, 7 and 11, in the 600th year of Noah's life is when the rains began, or that the flood was coming. So, and this is in the 601st year of Noah's life. He removed the covering. Now, that's a question. What is this covering that he removed? And you pursue the word, and when you get through with pursuing the word, you're going to come up with the conclusion that the word means covering. That really helped, didn't it? But Brown, Driver, and Briggs, and that's the lexicographer or lexicon for Hebrew, as Thayer is to Greek, and Bedag is to Greek. Brown, Driver, and Briggs suggest, and this may be somewhat interpretation, though they're lexicographers, that it means deck roof. And they suggest, and several commentators suggest, that when he talks about removing the covering, some have suggested there's some kind of covering that he put over the ark he starts peeling off. Well, it was pitched within and without, but I don't think it had reference to that. It may have had reference to the roof portion that he took a part of that off so that he can stand up and he can see then the ground. Makes sense? So apparently from the window he couldn't see the ground, whether it was dry, but he removes a portion of something called a covering, a roof deck, if you want to call it that, and you say, I don't think it was the roof deck. Well, then whatever you think it was, he took it off, and he could see then the ground. It enabled him to see. It's something larger, apparently, than that window. And that's about as far as I can go with that. All right. Now then, what does he do? Or what does God tell him? Verse 15. Yeah, he saw then that the ground was dry because he can look out. Verse 13 and 14. And so God speaks to him and says, go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons, and bring with you every living animal and bird and cattle, creeping thing, etc. And so he went out and all of his wife and his sons' wives and his sons, etc. And so they all went out. Now, starting at verse 20, our last section, Noah offers a sacrifice to God. Now, remember we talked about him taking the clean animals. There were seven of the clean animals, and then there were two of each of all the other animals, and here's perhaps why that was done. So he took of every clean animal and every clean bird. I don't think it means he took every clean animal and every clean bird and sacrifice, but of the clean animals, he took a bird and animal. Except, you see what I'm saying? He took from them, not all of them, and he made a sacrifice. And what did God do as a response to this sacrifice? All right. He makes a promise to Noah and his family that I never again will curse the ground for man's sake, even though what? Yeah, his imagination is on evil. Is in his heart from his youth. That's not a statement of man is a sinner from birth, but it's saying from his youth he learns and he sets his heart on doing evil and he continues to do, and that's just the way man has done And so, but even though that's the case, I will never again destroy every living thing as I've done. In other words, there's not going to be worldwide destruction by a flood. I'm not going to do that again. Now, while the earth remains, what's going to happen? That implies the earth's not going to remain. There's a time coming when the earth's not going to be anymore. But while it's existing, what's going to happen? Not going to cease. So the cycle of life is going to go on. You see any hint that maybe global warming is not the concept of global warming or climate change that's going to finally get to the point? I read a quote today that said, by the year 2000, we weren't going to have winters anymore. There's going to be summer everywhere all over the planet because the earth is warming up all the time. God said, as long as the earth stands, there's going to be cold and heat and winter and summer. It's going to continue. The cycle's going to continue. And so away with that concept. All right. Any questions on chapter 8? One of the questions, and I'm almost hesitant to bring it up because I don't know the full answer to it, it's more speculatory, is how many people were killed in the flood? How many? And there's all kinds of speculation. Some say just a few thousand, some say just a few 100,000, some say maybe 1 million. There's estimations of upwards of 2 million people, and that's based on the population going from 8 people at this point to what is it now? It's supposed to be around 7 to 8 billion, rather. Isn't that what we are, something like that, 7 to 8 billion? I think I'm right on that. And you take that number, and this is not perfect science, and then look at the number of years that they would have had, probably no more than 2 billion. And so the point is, let's say it's 1 billion, maybe it's 2 billion, maybe it's 3 billion, I don't know. But whatever the number was, it was a sizable world of people that died in the flood. It's not like there were 10,000 people that died in the flood. This was a sizable, they'd been on earth for 1,656 years. That's a lot of people. And only 8 of those people survived. Questions, comments? All right, let's move on. Let's go to chapter 9 now. What's chapter 9 about? All right, God has a covenant with Noah, and there's the case of Noah's drunkenness. Now, this is quite a section here, only 17 verses, but it's filled with quite a bit of information about God's covenant with Noah. And so let's see what he has to say here to Noah. So God blessed Noah. This is after that promise is made. Now, God's going to give him a sign of that same covenant. I don't think that what we're about to see here about God's covenant is something different, but we're going to see a sign of that same covenant. And so the first thing he tells Noah is to do what? It's not a surprise if we're familiar with Genesis 1. Multiply. And so just as God gave Adam and Eve the instructions, now here you are. We have a man and a woman. Y'all multiply and replenish the earth. So y'all multiply, and so mankind is going to grow. Well, they're going to grow quite a bit by the time we get to chapter 10. Some time is going to pass. Then, verses 2 to 4, man is given power over animals, just like he was in creation, but it goes further here. What do we see different in this section of 2 to 4 we haven't seen so far? Man was given command over the animal kingdom. They're given for meat. Yeah. And so up to this point, there's no indication that they were given permission to eat the animals. Maybe they were. We're just not told. But at this point, God gives some instructions. That's what they're for. So again, this is not a political statement. This is just a biblical statement. The animal rights people who think it's just terrible, you kill an animal, you kill a cow, you kill a chicken, you kill whatever, and you eat it. That's just terrible. It's horrible. And we shouldn't eat meat, etc. God made animals for meat. And that's just the case of the matter. So let's look at verses 2, 3, and 4. That the fear of you shall, and the dread of you shall be on every beast. In other words, God was going to create it so that they submit to mankind. That'll be given in your hand. Every moving living thing, look at verse 3, shall be to you for food. Now, you may have a marginal note over in chapter 1 somewhere. Forgot where we made that point. Chapter 1 and in verse 29 and 30, the permission to eat meat came later. That's chapter 9, verse 3. You might want to make a note to chapter 9, verse 3, back to chapter 1, verse 29. This is where that permission is given, that it was given for food, even as green herbs. In other words, eat the animals just like the herbs I give you. Just go ahead and eat that. But there was one restriction. Not eat the blood. Why? Life is in the blood. Leviticus 17 makes the same point. That's not the only two texts that do that, but Leviticus 17 is one of the most highlighted passages on that point, as well as Genesis 9, that life is in the blood. And that's why God demands blood sacrifice when it comes time for the sacrifices under the Mosaic covenant. And ultimately, the blood sacrifice of Christ is because life is in the blood. So that principle is why blood's not to be eaten. Life is still in the blood, and we still shouldn't eat blood. Acts 15 says so. It's recorded in Acts 15. But then that's also a reason for something else here. In fact, let's go to question number six. What principle of justice do you learn? Capital punishment. Yeah. And there's two reasons actually given in the context. One, I think, is specifically stating, the other one is implied, that God demands capital punishment. And so that's not a terrible thing. That's not a bad thing. God thinks it should be done. And the two reasons are what? One's at verse 4, one's at verse 6. All right, yeah, verse 5, that's the capital punishment. Well, let's focus on the reason at verse 6. Let's get that one first, then we'll go back to verse 4. Yeah, because man is made in the image of God. And the second thing is that there is life in the blood. So this murderer should be put to death. Why? If he's guilty, if we find him guilty. Well, because life is in the blood, and because he killed one that's made in the image of God. So the animals are not in the image of God. There's a difference in animals and man. All right? So verse 5 has been a little obscure for some. Surely, for your lifeblood, I will demand a reckoning. That is, you kill and take a life, then there's a reckoning for that. And at the hand of every beast will I require it. Now, that's not saying that God's going to call the animals in and hold them accountable as if they're moral creatures that give an account for their morality. That's not what he's saying. But there are numerous passages in the book of Exodus and Leviticus that if an animal gored a man, what were you to do to the animal? You killed it. So consequently, that's what he's saying here, that I have respect for lifeblood, and so if an animal even does that, you take his life. Now, there's no morality involved, but God's requiring that because of the respect for human life. And so from the hand of every man's brother, I will require life of a man. Reckon why he mentioned from his brother. Yeah, Cain killed Abel. I think it's a direct reference to Cain and Abel, that when that kind of thing happens again, you're to kill him. Make sense? God doesn't think much of murder. All right. You might circle, underline, highlight, do whatever with verse 6. That's a powerful verse for you. Verse 4 and verse 6, life being in the blood, and whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for he's in the image of God. All right, for he made him. Now, let's see where I want to go. Now, let's continue verse 7. I'm ready to go on to verse 8, though. Let's go to verse 8 through 17. This is about what? The rainbow being given as a... Yeah, it's a sign of a covenant. It's not the covenant itself, but it is a sign or a symbol and a reminder of the covenant. All right, let's see what it says. So God said that, behold, I establish my covenant with your descendants. And so again, God establishes, verse 10 and 11, what the covenant is, which is what? I will never again destroy all of mankind by a flood. I'll never will do that again. And so there will never again will there be a flood. I'm reading at the end of verse 11, to destroy the earth. So now verse 12, this is the sign of the covenant. And so the rainbow is not the covenant itself, but it's the sign that I make between me and you and every living creature. And so God's going to set his rainbow in the cloud, verse 13, and it shall be that when I bring the cloud over the earth, the rainbow shall be seen. All right, just exactly like God said. Now, let's finish that section, then we're going to talk about the meaning of the rainbow. Let's see, what else did I want to point out? Look at verse 15, I will remember. Now, this is interesting, that God doesn't say, I'm giving you this rainbow so that you remember, but he's saying, I'm going to put that there and I will remember. Now, it is for us to remember too, but it's interesting, God said, when the rainbow's there, I think the wording of that basically is saying, so that you know and are assured that I remember that. Does that make sense? So you are assured that I remember my covenant. All right. Questions or comments? And so on. I look on and remember every living, the everlasting covenant, an every living creature. So verse 17 has finished that section. Then we're going to raise some questions about the rainbow. This will be a sign of the covenant that I've established between me and all the flesh of the earth. So the rainbow was a sign of that. Let's go to question number 8. What does the rainbow mean to us today? Yeah. So every time you see it, it reminds you God said he would never again. So here it is raining, and it's raining, and it's raining, and it's raining, and floodwaters are rising, and you see a rainbow. That reminds you it ain't going to be like it was before. See, God said he would destroy the world in 120 years, and he did. And then God said no longer do that again, and he hasn't. And so every time we see that, we know God did exactly what he said. What else? Question number, what was that, number 8? Good point. We can trust any other promise that hasn't yet been fulfilled, like I will come again, Jesus said. I know he will, because he kept this promise. Good point. Good point. What else? Question number 8. What does a rainbow mean? We have allowed the immoral society to steal that rainbow from us. That rainbow does not mean to encompass homosexuality and approve of that. It's a promise from the divine creator. And so we ought to talk about the rainbow and take it back away from them because they have stole that and misused it. Agree? All right, let's go further. Let's start at verse 18 now, and let's talk about Noah's drunkenness and the curse upon Canaan. So we have here the case of Noah getting drunk. Now, Noah, let's talk about Noah's family here for a moment. These are the descendants of Noah. The cross here represents, and there's a whole series of these slides, and I'm just picking some of these out. And maybe one day we'll string them all together. We had from Adam, and the cross on this represents the lineage of Christ through whom the Messiah could be traced back to Adam. I didn't mean to do that. And so you have Noah, and he has these three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. But Shem is the one through whom the lineage is going to come. Make sense? So it's through this side of the family, through Shem, that the family of Israel, the Israelites, are going to come. That nation is going to come. So we're chapter 9. By chapter 12, it's going to be out of that lineage that we have the children of Abraham. Make sense? All right? But there's some significance of Ham and Ham's child here, Canaan, from whom the Canaanites are named. So the Canaanites, the Gibeonites, etc., from Japheth and Ham, we learn some things here in this context. So let's talk about Noah getting drunk here. When they came out of the ark, the text says, here are the sons, and from them the whole earth was populated. In other words, these are our kinfolks we're talking about. We all go right back to these to Noah. But verse 29 said he planted a vineyard And then he drank with wine and was drunk and became uncovered in his tent. Now let's talk about his drunkenness for a moment. You may have some marginal note to this effect from previous studies. Drunkenness may have been a sin at this point. I'm not convinced that it was. And here's some evidence of that. There is no record of a law against it. That doesn't mean there wasn't. God could have given them a law. If you plant a vineyard, don't drink of the and don't get drunk. God could have said that. That's very possible. Because God said a lot of things he didn't record. So that's altogether possible. I'll give you that. But we have no record of it. But I think probably the strongest thing is the fact that there is no condemnation of Noah here. There is some condemnation of Ham, and we'll talk about whether that's true or not, and Canaan, and I think that's because he's a descendant of Ham, but not of Noah. Why was Noah not condemned if this was sinful? But it has nothing to do with whether it's sinful for us, because it is sinful in our day and time because of Galatians chapter 5 and other passages. That's just a sampling of that. You may say, well, I think it was a sin. Have at that. I won't argue that. I'm just suggesting that there seems to be some explanation. Why didn't God rebuke Noah for his drunkenness here? I don't know. Maybe he did, and we're just not told. I'm just throwing that out for what that may be worth. Now, notice at verse 22 that Noah is in his tent and he's naked. Now, Leviticus 18, and here's a, let's get ahead of ourselves. Let's go ahead and get a question. I think you have question number 7. What do you learn about how nakedness should be viewed? And it is equated with shame. Yeah, that's the point. Leviticus 18 says one's nakedness was not to be seen by another. You're not to see your mother's nakedness or your father's nakedness. And so there was a sense of shame to be associated with that. Did they understand that? There seems to be some understanding of that at this point. Else, why did Shem and Japheth do what they did? There was some sense of shame. So what was the problem here? Well, look at verse 22. And Ham, the father of Canaan... That's interesting, he identifies, he had other children, but the father of Canaan saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. Now there is some conjecture here, but it doesn't seem to me to make sense that he ran and told them, and let's just pretend for a moment he went and told them, said, we've got to do something, Dad is embarrassing himself and us, and would y'all help me cover him? And then they go and cover him, and then Ham is the one that is rebuked here and his descendants. And so it seems to be implied by the word told here that there seems to be some ridicule and not telling them in order that something may be done, because it seems that they take, notice the wording of verse 23, but Shem and Japheth took a garment. There seems to be a contrast. He went and told it, perhaps in ridicule, making fun of, or not dealing with it as it should be. But the other two brothers did. Does that make sense? That makes sense to me. That seems to be what was done. It seems to be implied. I can't. And you say, well, no. I think he went and told them to get some cover. Well, okay, have at that. I hadn't seen the evidence of that. All right. Now, notice at verse 23, what do they do? Not only what do they do, how do they do it? They take a garment and go back in, looking away so that they cover his nakedness without seeing him. So they're showing some dignity and respect and recognizing that there is some shame connected with nakedness, and so they cover their father. Now, that's all we know about the story, except for Noah's reaction to that. And that's where we want to focus now. And I think we have to focus on that word told. And it doesn't tell us a whole lot. I think it'd be like you retelling a story that something was done and somebody went and told it. You hadn't implied anything, maybe, but we have to deduce from that. Was that told in ridicule? Was it told to try to get help? Well, da 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 da. Make sense? All right. Now, start at verse 24. When Noah woke up from his wine, in other words, he got sober, and knew that his youngest son knew what he had done, that is Ham, then he prophesied. This seems to be prophecy here, not just a prediction. Some commentators talk about that, and I don't know that it's necessary to even make this point, but that he began to curse. It's not curse like in anger. He's pronouncing a curse. This is prophetic. This is what's going to become of the descendants of my sons. Does that make sense? So the question is, why curse Canaan and not Ham? Ham was the one that done it. And yet he says, curse be Canaan. And I take it that this is a case of visiting the consequence upon the next generation. And that he's using Canaan actually to stand for the descendants of Ham. And so Ham is being condemned, I take it. I don't think he's saying, Ham did something wrong, I'm going to pronounce punishment upon his son. And only one of his sons. I don't think that's the case. I think it's prophetic of their descendants. And we're going to see that fulfilled a little bit later. So let's get the picture. Look at verse 25. Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants, he shall be to his brethren. Canaan's going to be a servant. And he said, blessed be the Lord of Shem, may Canaan be his servant, and may God enlarge Japheth, and he may dwell in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant. In other words, these two brothers that we just talked about right here, these two brothers and their descendants are going to be servants, not of Shem himself, but of the descendants. In other words, from Shem is going to come the Israelites. From the other two brothers are going to come the Gibeonites and the Canaanites, and they are going to be in service to him. Judges 9, and then the whole book of Joshua, for that matter. Does that make sense? It's going to come to fulfill. So I take this to be a prophecy that's being foretold of the future of the descendants. Make sense? And so when we come to Judges 9, when we come to the book of Joshua, if we remember to do it, we'll come back and point out that this is the case of the descendants of Ham are now becoming servants of the descendants of Shem. Make sense? Tracking with me? All right, now well, let's get the last note here at verse 28 and 29. Our time is about gone. Noah lived after the flood another 350 years, making the total of his years 950. What a life. What a ride, I tell you. That's a long ride there. You think you feel old? Think when you got to be about 800 and think, I might have another 100 years, 150. Anyway, he lived 950 years. And that's the end of that story. So let's go, let's see, we got time for this. Let's go to question number 9. Practical things you learn from these chapters, plural. Things you take home. Practical stuff. Very good, yeah. Every time God makes a promise, he always keeps his promise. He always has, always will. Good point. What else? Let's get another one or two. Good point. Good point. If you didn't catch what Diane said, because of the others that were mentioned in Genesis 5, that when Noah and his family get in the ark, they had to have family that was outside the ark that wasn't going to make it. I'll let that sink in for a minute. They had to have people that they knew were drowning in the flood, and they were not allowed in because they didn't hear the preaching, or at least didn't heed the preaching, and how sad that had to be. But they were outside the ark. They had family there. And we've got family that's not in the ark. And that's also sad. We'll stop on that note right there.